Your brain needs support, and new Ollie Brainy Chews are a delightful way to take care of your cognitive health. Made with scientifically backed ingredients like Thai ginger, L-theanine, and caffeine, Brainy Chews support healthy brain function and help you find your focus, stay chill, or get energized. Be kind to your mind and get these nootropic chews at Ollie.com. That's OLLY.com. These statements have not been evaluated by the Food and Drug Administration. This product is not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease.
Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
This episode is brought to you by FX's The Veil, starring Elizabeth Moss. FX's The Veil is an international spy thriller that follows two women as they play a deadly game of truth and lies on the road from Istanbul to Paris and London. One woman has a secret, and the other has a mission to reveal it before thousands of lives are lost. FX's The Veil premieres April 30th, only on Hulu.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, I'm Nicholas Gordon, host of the Asian Review of Books podcast, done in collaboration with the New Books Network. In this podcast, we interview fiction and nonfiction authors working in, around, and about the Asia-Pacific region. Many of us have likely seen photos of the Aral Sea and the rusted Soviet-era ships sitting in the desert with no water in sight. The Aral Sea is now just 10% of its former volume, shrinking down from what was once the fourth largest body of inland water in the world, after what writer Jeff Fernside calls one of the worst human-caused environmental catastrophes. Jeff traveled to the region as a Peace Corps volunteer. Afterwards, he turned his experiences into an essay collection, Ships in the Desert, where Jeff writes about the families he met, his thoughts on missionaries, and his visit to the Aral Sea, where he saw, quote, a fleet of rusting Soviet fishing ships, hammer and sickle still clearly discernible on many, sitting bolt upright in desert sands as if plowing through ocean waves. Jeff Fernside is the author of the short story collection Making Love While Levitating 3 Feet in the Air, which won the 2005 SFWP Awards program. He is also author of the chapbook And Husband and Wife Are One Satan, winner of the Orison Chapbook Prize. His work has appeared in literary journals and anthologies such as The Paris Review, Los Angeles Review, Story, and many others. Today, Jeff and I talk about what inspired his essays, including what he saw in the barren Aral Sea. So, Jeff, thanks for coming on the show to talk about your book. My first question is, you know, what brought you to this region? What brought you to Kazakhstan in the first place? And, you know, what was it like at the time, you know, compared to what it was perhaps like before or like since?
Mm-hmm. I joined an organization here in the U.S. Called the Peace Corps, which I'm sure most of your readers, your listeners are familiar with. And in the Peace Corps, you don't get to choose the country you go to. You're allowed to pick a region. And I had been teaching at the university level, and I wanted to continue teaching at that level. So I did my research, and in the Peace Corps, you can, at that time, you could either go to Eastern Europe or Central Asia, and I was drawn to Central Asia. So that was the region that I applied to do my service, and it ended up being in Kazakhstan. So this is exactly 2 decades ago, 2002. And the Soviet Union, of course, had dissolved in 1991. So when I visited Kazakhstan, it was just a little more than a decade after the fall of the Soviet Union. And so times were still hard there, which is one of the reasons why the Peace Corps was involved and had programs in the country. And I heard from others who had been there much longer than I had been, you know, as a newcomer, that times had been really tough throughout the 1990s. They were just beginning to turn around, Some of the policies that they had enacted at that time were beginning to take effect. So I wasn't entering a country of abject poverty, but it was a country that had been on hard times, and it was a challenge. But it was a challenge I really looked forward to, and the people I found to be friendly, resilient, and really, really eager to meet Americans and really anybody from other countries and cultures, because after the fall of the Soviet Union, everything had opened up, and the people were so curious. So I felt very, very welcome there, and did my full two years as a teacher at a university. It was amazingly rewarding.
Well, I mean, let's talk about kind of the hard times the region had been facing, the country had been facing, and let's talk about your title essay, which is Ships in the Desert, which is about the disaster in the Aral Sea, which is one of these, maybe kind of less famous now, but it's one of those kind of big symbols of resource overuse, of environmental disasters, of the steady shrinking of the Aral Sea to almost nothing. But let's start with kind of like, so what people kind of know this happened, maybe don't know why it happened or what the repercussions have been. What caused the shrinking of the Aral Sea, and what are its continued effects today?
Mm-hmm. Well, the initial causes were pretty simple. It was mismanagement due to greed and corruption. I think we can boil it down to that. The Soviets wanted to grow cotton in the desert, which is not necessarily a bad idea. Cotton likes growing in those kinds of environments, but cotton requires enormous amounts of water. And the Soviets weren't satisfied with planting a sustainable amount of cotton. They had big plans for it. It was a big moneymaker for them. And they simply stretched the limits of their resources way beyond what the possibly could have held. The water canals that fed the cotton fields were not especially well built to begin with. They were essentially open ditches. A lot of water lost to evaporation, to spillage, leakage. And then the overuse of water, too much was being drawn to the cotton fields. But there was no incentive to stop this because too much money was flowing in into the coffers of the people in charge. And they essentially turned a blind eye to what was happening. We could see the sea beginning to shrink even in the 1960s, but they continued to plant more and more cotton, until eventually the effects of the loss of water became quite noticeable. And at that point, some other effects began to kick in. Because the climate, the regional climate began changing. As the sea shrank, there was less water to then contribute to the surrounding atmosphere. And so the entire region became hotter and drier, and which, of course, exacerbated the problem because now there was even less water to be fed into the Aral Sea. And then on top of that, because of some related issues, cotton's not only a crop that demands a lot of water, it's a crop that demands a lot of chemicals to be grown, defoliants and pesticides and herbicides. All of this is flowing into the system, the water system. And as the Aral Sea dried out, of course, all of these noxious chemicals simply came to the surface and began blowing around in these noxious storms, literally of what we could say are biblical proportions, that blue pesticides and very harmful chemicals is as far as the Pacific Ocean. And we're talking Kazakhstan and Uzbekistan are landlocked countries. So these chemicals are being blown thousands of kilometers and miles away. Of course, the effect to the local people was enormous, the health effects. They have high rates of various kinds of cancer, thyroid problems, and birth defects, and on and on and on. And then finally, there's a third effect that's continuing today, and that's more recent, and that's the effect of global climate change. In addition to the regional changes in the weather caused by the drying of the Aral Sea, now we're seeing the glaciers in the mountains that feed the streams that feed the Aral are now shrinking. So there's less water in the rivers to even make it to the Aral Sea nowadays. And in fact, on most of the time, the water of the Amu Darya and the Sir Darya, the two rivers that feed the Aral Sea, never reaches the sea. They just peter out into the sands and are absorbed into the sands. So it's that threefold effect, the mismanagement, which was due to greed and corruption, and then the effect of the regional climate changing, which exacerbated the problem and caused it to spiral. And then finally, the global climate change that we see now that is melting glaciers and further reducing the water that makes it to the Aral. So the Aral is essentially 5% of what it was 60 years ago. So this is, we're talking about the fourth largest inland body of water, and it shrunk to 5% of its former self. So that'll tell you the scale of the disaster that we're looking at.
You know, and I think many people have probably seen the photos of the rusted ships kind of lying in the middle of the desert. I mean, that's what inspired the title of your essay and your book. But what's it actually like there? You know, on the ground. On, I guess, the former shores of the Aral Sea. What's it actually like in this environmental disaster?
Well, we actually saw the ships not on the former shores, but much farther into what had been the sea. And the reason for that is as the sea was receding and the level was dropping, the fishing fleet, and I should back up here and say that at one time the Aral Sea had a thriving fishery, and it was an important fishery for the Soviet Union. So the fishing fleet kept retreating to the deeper part of the sea, and eventually they retreated to a point where they could retreat no more. And that's where the ships settled into what was the sea bottom and where they rest now. So we're talking, you know, scores of kilometers from the original shore. And that's what's so startling about it. When you drive across the former seabed for these scores of kilometers, and then you come out into what is essentially a desert, and there are camels grazing out there now, and then you see these ships bolt upright in the sands as if they were still plowing through water, and it almost seems an impossibility. And the reason for it is, of course, as I said, they had retreated to the deepest part of the sea. And so as the sea sank and the ships sank, they just settled into the mud and settled deeper and deeper into that mud. And they just anchored themselves there. We went out to see these ships with a Kazakh guide, Agitai. And he was a local person. He grew up in the area, and he remembered what it had been like. He estimated that the ships had anchored out there in the early 1970s. So at the time I saw them, they had been out there for 30 years. And there they were, as if they had just sailed out of the port yesterday. And you can walk right up to them. You can climb on board, and we did. And it's amazing and it's unsettling. And to touch the disaster in such a tangible way is really what sparked me to write that essay. And that was the essay that began the book. Because once I had touched those ships, once I had stepped aboard, once I had actually put my hand into the former seabed and sifted my fingers through the sand of the former seabed, I had touched the disaster. I was a part of it. And being a part of it, I felt like I had to say something about it. I couldn't just let it go unrecognized. So, that's why I chose the title "Ships in the Desert." It was that image, and it was that encounter with something so, I guess you would say, a tangible ghost of the past that led me to write what eventually became the entire book, "Ships in the Desert."
You know, and you make an observation in that essay, which I'm going to spin off into a broader question. But of course, you do connect the disaster in the Aral Sea to similar disasters in the United States, things like the Salton Sea. I think it's a reminder that we read about disasters, about bad things that happen in other places, and we think it's kind of it's happening overseas in the other, but in fact, it's got parallels to what's going on in developed countries like the U.S. But I want to kind of use this observation you make as a sparking point for a larger question, which you can talk about this and other things, which is kind of how did your time in Kazakhstan change how you thought about the U.S. and how the U.S. Handles these sorts of problems, deals with these sorts of social questions?
Yeah, well, that's a good question. I have never been one of those people who unquestionably buys into everything that my own government tells me. I certainly understood that the United States, like any country, has its many wonderful points, and it also has points, areas that where we can improve. But you see those kinds of things more clearly when you have a chance to live abroad. And it was very important for me to connect what I saw with the Aral Sea to the water issues in the United States, because human nature is human nature, no matter what country we're talking about. Mismanagement, corruption, greed, this is not limited to any one country or any one part of the world. And we sometimes, I think, any inhabitant of their own country sometimes becomes a little insulated and begins to feel like, oh, well, we're doing it right and everyone else is doing it wrong. But what I saw at the Aral Sea made me realize that there are direct parallels to what happened there and what is happening here in the United States. I like to tell people that I'm very, very sad that I was so right about my predictions in the book. At the time I began the book, no one was really talking about water issues to a large degree in the United States. I mean, we were certainly aware of climate change. And out west, in the American West, certainly we were aware of water, but not to any huge extent, I would say, to the extent where it was really an alarm. And I saw what was happening. I saw the writing on the wall, I guess you would say. And I wrote about the Salton Sea, and I wrote about the falling Ogallala Aquifer, which is the largest aquifer in the Midwestern United States, which is dropping at a rate that it's expected to be dry by the end of this century. We're talking an aquifer that feeds the heartland of the United States, the agriculture there. This would be a huge disaster if indeed the aquifer failed. And the reason for it is the same as the reason for why the Aral Sea fell. We're overpumping the aquifer, and we're doing it because we are planting. We planted too much. We're too much farmland needs to be. Water needs to be watered, and we're over pumping this very important water resource. So it happens here. So I wrote about all of this, and then the book comes out earlier this year during one of the hottest summers on record. And what are we looking at now? Lake Powell is at a historic low. The Colorado River is at a historic low. The Mississippi River is at a historic low. The Great Salt Lake is at a historic low. We're having water crises all over the place. And again, I get no pleasure that I saw these things written in the cards. But my hope... a large driver for wanting to write this book is that maybe now we can look at these issues. Maybe now we can begin discussing them openly, but not just talking about them, but facing them, creating plans, working out these issues, because we don't have any more time. So, yes, the Aral Sea may seem like something, a relic of the Soviet Union, past practices of a country that is now gone, but it's not. The echoes of it are resounding around the world. America is certainly not the only place where water issues are a problem. This is happening everywhere, and it's going to continue to happen with climate change. And its attendant issue of global warming. So, we need to look at it. We need to talk about it. We need to come up with some plans now. That's pretty much where that lays.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious, ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
So, this conversation is reminding me about another essay you talk about, another essay from your book, which is the essay titled The Missionary Position, which is about missionaries in Kazakhstan, which kind of prompts you to think about what it means to, it's always to be a missionary, to be a representative of a certain point of view and trying to spread that point of view in another place. And I wondered if I might ask you to kind of talk a bit about that essay and what prompted you to kind of delve into or kind of just interrogate this idea of being a missionary.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I certainly have no problems with missionaries per se. And as I talk about in the essay, I believe in some way or another, we're all missionaries. We all have ideas that we wish to grow or propagate, which is the Latin propagare is the root word for propaganda, which has a lot of negative connotations. But at the same time, it simply means, it's action that is designed to grow an idea or to spread an idea. And we all have those, right? So propaganda can be good. Public health announcements are a form of propaganda that is good. Anti-smoking announcements, only you can prevent forest fires, these kinds of things. So propaganda doesn't have to be bad. So we all have a message, and I realized that as a teacher in Kazakhstan, I had a message as well. I taught literature, and literature inherently carries messages with it. So my initial drive wasn't necessarily to single out religious missionaries, but I did notice that there were a small group of missionaries that were not being as forthcoming about their reasons for being there. And that did bother me. One of the main points of that essay is I really express a desire for people to be religiously tolerant. And I think, it's important for me to honor and respect everyone's religion. And in return, I hope that others will do the same. And if I see that perhaps a certain group is not respecting another group, then certainly that that was troubling to me to some degree, and perhaps what sparked me to write the essay. But again, as I got into it more and I began thinking more about it, I realized it's really about the messages we have and how we all carry them, whether they're religious, spiritual, social, political, environmental. In my case, right, the Ships in the Desert has a strongly pro-environmental message to it. I saw this as perhaps being a key to help us speak to each other in today's highly, highly polarized times. Not just here in America, we're seeing it in Europe, we're seeing it all over the world. Everything has become so polarized, and groups of people are having such a hard time talking to each other. And with the environmental problems that I was talking about earlier, and I mentioned that we need to come together, we need to start talking about these problems, we need to start implementing plans. Well, how can we do that if we're so polarized? And the missionary position was about recognizing that because we all have our own messages, because we all have our own propaganda, the ideas we want to grow, if we can recognize that, then we can begin honoring that and respecting that. And that might be the key to helping us talk to each other. Because then instead of approaching the other person or another group of people with the idea that I am right and they are wrong, we can approach each other with the idea that I have ideas I want to grow. They have ideas they want to grow. Where can we meet in the middle? So ultimately, that's my hope for what the missionary position, what people will take away from it, the idea of the importance of religious tolerance for sure, but also the more broad idea of the tolerance of any idea in the marketplace of ideas, so that we can talk to each other.
Yeah, and speaking of talking to each other, I've asked about kind of your two big essays in the book, but there are also a lot of smaller, shorter, more personal stories that deal with your interactions with people in Kazakhstan while you were there. I'm thinking especially of the first essay, the very first essay in the book, which is about your first host family and your meeting them, and specifically meeting Etam, kind of the head of the household. I wonder if you might talk a bit more just about the people that you met during your time in Kazakhstan, and kind of what it was like to meet these people, talk to these people, get to know these people.
Yeah, the bulk of the book is largely about the environmental concerns and the cultural concerns that we've already talked about. But it was really important for me to bring in more personal stories. And that's why the book begins with the essay Itam about my host father and my host family. And it also ends with Itam and the host family with a very, very brief essay at the end. And I wanted those personal stories to bookend the book. One, to make the point that these larger environmental and cultural issues really are tied to personal issues, right? That we can't separate these things out. What happens in our lives, it is the environmental, the political, the spiritual, the religious, and the personal. All these things are intertwined. But more importantly, I wanted to bring these stories that were important to me into this mix. Someday I'll probably write an entire book only based on these personal stories. But for now, we have a few of them mixed in to this current book. And Itam, I wanted to lead off with that because he and his family were my first experience with the real Kazakhstan. Obviously, I had met my Peace Corps teachers, and they're wonderful people. They were the Peace Corps, the local Peace Corps staff was tremendous. But I didn't spend a lot of time, and we were sent right off to the villages and to our host families to begin our immersion training, our language training, and cultural training. And Itam and his family welcomed me into their home as if I were a member of the family. And I later came to find out that's very typically Kazakhstani. People there will welcome you in as if you are a member of the family, if they like you. So evidently they liked me. And I really can't emphasize enough how they shaped what ended up being my entire experience there, which ended up being 4 years long. It was all influenced from there, the initial 2.5 months I spent with Itam and his family. So something happens to Itam. I don't want to give it away. It's something in the book that you'll have to read about, but because of what happens, that also prompted me to want to open with this story because it was an emotional event for me that I, after all this time, I still haven't fully reconciled myself with. So this is one small way I can honor them for all they did for me by writing this essay and leading off with it in the book.
So I think I wanted to kind of close off our conversation by asking about what's happened since the time you spent in Kazakhstan for the book. I mean, have you kept an eye on the country since you left? Has it changed since the time you were there for the Peace Corps and later as a fellowship manager?
Yeah, well, everything. Any relationship you have with a person or a place is going to change depending on your perspective. And if you have a narrow perspective, then your relationship to a person or place will inevitably be narrow. And if you bring a broader perspective to a relationship, that relationship will inevitably be broader, richer, deeper. And so anytime you're in a position to see something from a different perspective, that allows you to broaden yourself and your perspective. So certainly, you know, as we talked about a little bit earlier, going overseas helped me see my own country a little better. And it was the same. Returning from America and then looking back on Kazakhstan helped me to see Kazakhstan in an even broader light than I had been able to see it when I was living there. So certainly I've kept up with it. I got married over there. My wife is from Kazakhstan. Certainly it's a country that's still very important to us. We have family there. I've never really lost touch with it. We've been able to visit only once since my initial time there. Unfortunately, we're planning on going back again here soon. But in today's age, of course, we're able to keep in touch with WhatsApp, you know, cell phones, the internet, things like that. We've got a lot of other ways to stay connected to people. Social media, you know, I'm still in touch with many of my former students, former colleagues. So yeah, I'm aware of what's going on. I'm happy to say the country has grown a lot. Those bumpy years that I experienced are I mean, largely gone. The country is certainly more affluent now, more settled now than it was before. You know, I think like anything, the people there are still looking ahead to a lot of different things. You know, I don't want to get too much into global situations, but certainly with the unrest happening with their large neighbor to the north right now, it causes a lot of cause for concern for people there, as it should. But, you know, the people there, they're resilient, and I'm sure that they'll come through fine. I feel no less connected to Kazakhstan now than I did during my time that I lived there in some weird way. And I think a lot of Peace Corps volunteers can speak to this. You almost feel a pride in your country, your host country. You know, maybe not the same as the pride you take in your home country, but you certainly feel a sense of pride when you see it in the news and you see that they've, you know, something good has happened. So yeah, it's a country that, you know, I lived there for 4 years. It was a hugely important part of my life during a hugely important transitional part of my life. And, it'll always be an important place to me.
So I think with that ends our conversation with Jeff Fernside, author of Ships in the Desert. Jeff, I actually have two final questions for you, which are, where can people find your work? And what's next for you? What might the next project be?
Mm-hmm. Well, you can find me online, Jeff-Fernside, FEARNSIDE.com. And all the information about my books is there. The easiest way to buy them anywhere in the world would be on Amazon.com. So that would be another resource I'd direct you to. As far as my next project, unsurprisingly, it's a book set in Kazakhstan. It's a novel that I've been working on for a while. I've completed a draft, and I feel it's pretty good. So I'm at the point right now where I'm diving in, and I'm giving it another run through, and I hope, if all goes well, to have it finished within a year. We'll see how it goes.
So you can follow me, Nicholas Gordon, on Twitter at NickRIGordon. That's NickRIGordon. You can go to AsianReviewOfBooks.com to find other reviews, essays, interviews, and excerpts. Follow on Twitter at BookReviewsAsia. And you can find many more author interviews at the New Books Network at NewBooksNetwork.com. We hope you subscribe and listen to the Asian Review Books podcast on all your favorite podcast apps, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and Stitcher. Rate us, recommend us, share us with your friends to support us continuing to interview those writing in, around, and about Asia. Next week, join us for an interview with Uther Charleston Stevens, author of Anglo-India and the End of Empire. But before then, Jeff, thank you so much for talking with me today.
Well, Nicholas, thank you very much. I really appreciate you taking the time, and I appreciate your interest in my book and in these issues.